My name is Drew Podwall. I'm joined by my co-host, Brad Nelson.
Hello, Agilis.
And we're kind of winging this one today. We have a backlog list of different ideas and topics and whatnot, but I've got to go pick up my dog in about an hour and a half. Otherwise, he's going to stay the night and my fiance is not going to forgive me for not getting him on time. So we were talking about a couple of different ideas. And you know, one of the things that speaks to me lately that I've heard a lot of people say is that people are bringing up Xu Ha and Ri. And they're also talking a lot about, I hear, if you're not doing X and Y and Z, then you can't call it Scrum.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it would be interesting to talk about how those two statements that seem to get, you know, made by well-known agilists and Scrum masters and Scrum enthusiasts left and right balance off one another. Because from my perspective, I want to celebrate wins, right? And I want to celebrate small wins and incremental wins. And so, you know, if we're defining Xu Ha and Ri as getting your feet wet and, you know, learning the rules and trying your best to strive towards Scrum, and then Ha is the getting to a place where, you know, you've got mastery. And then Ri is this place where you're able to now break the rules because you don't need the rules anymore. Well, like you said, right? At what point do you get to say that you're doing Scrum?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. This reminds me of our talk on Agile Purism a bit as well.
Yeah.
And they definitely go hand in hand. And so, yeah, you know, as we're looking through the different levels of maturity, and that's a term that has become pretty common in the Agile community. And I've heard arguments that you shouldn't use the term maturity because it's not appropriate to, or it's demeaning, I guess, to say like, oh, you're just not mature. But I've yet to come up with a better word for it, you know. But at the same time, like, at what point other uses of that word do you consider someone mature? Like, are you an adult? Is that like the definition of mature? Well, that's like an age thing.
Yeah.
So do I have to be doing Agile for 18 years to be Agile? You know, what does that look like?
At what age should you consider yourself a mature adult, Brad? You brought it up.
I still don't some days.
Okay. you know, I'm the same way for sure. I like to say that 16-year-old Drew, whenever I'm doing something new, 16-year-old Drew would be proud or aghast or disappointed or embarrassed or whatever. So there's still that dichotomy between 47-year-old Drew and 16-year-old Drew. So
definitely.
But, you know, like to me, when I'm coaching organizations and working with teams, there's two sides to everything that we're coaching from my perspective. There's the culture part of it, which nobody ever really wants to talk about or understand, and it's really rare. And then there's the processes, right, that don't work without the culture, right?
Right.
And like, you know, that like, should there be, is there like a pre-shoe phase, right? Like that describes the impossible negotiation where you're trying to negotiate a way to be agile or to do agile without being agile, you know, like a pre-shoe phase, or is that considered part of shoe?
I mean, that's a good question. I haven't thought of it in those terms, but I would say that, right, like to me, Xu is the phase of you're being taught. Right? It's like actively being taught by a teacher. This is what you do in this situation. Or, you know, if we think of Scrum, right, you're actively being taught the Scrum framework. And in an ideal scenario, you're following those teachings to a T. And then the Ha is like, okay, I followed it to a T. Now, what can I experiment with? If you're a parent, like I think of Xu Ha Ri in the terms of parenting a lot. So, you know, you tell your kids every day, stop running in the house, stop running in the house. There's a reason for that. They don't quite know it yet because they haven't experienced it. They haven't lived it. They will usually respond in the moment and stop running, right? Because you're teaching them. But it's not until they run into the wall or trip and fall and hurt themselves that they realize, oh, there is a reason why we don't run in the house. And so that's kind of that Ha phase where a team is learning, oh, this is why we do daily Scrum or whatever it is.
Well, let's think about that for a second, right? Because I like the analogy you're talking about with your child, right? It's one of the things that I think is great about my son is that, like, I mean, everybody says that, but is that, you know, he, we let him make mistakes on his own, right? We created an environment where he could make mistakes in a way that, like, there was one time, and this is bad. This is a good story, but a bad story. When I was a kid, I used to blow up Bic lighters, right? It was the late 70s, early 80s. It was the early 80s. I was kidding. I'm not kidding myself. But it was the early 80s, right? We would go out into the woods and we would do stuff like that. We would, you know, take Bic lighters and we would throw them against, you know, and I think I had told Jake that story at some point. Because, you know, we had a house in Vermont. We, you know, lit fireworks together and stuff. And I wanted him to learn how to be safe, right? And take risks and be safe. And so one day he's like, can you show me how you did that Bic lighter thing? And I said to him, you know what, Jake? That's something you're going to have to figure out on your own. Like, I don't think it's appropriate for me to go to the store and buy you a Bic lighter and show you how to blow it up. You know, if you could figure that out on your own, just make sure you're safe, right? And I bring that up because, you know, in order for people to truly understand a process or a methodology, they have to experience it and they have to have those aha moments, right? Where it clicks, right? And so if you're saying like the no running in the house rule, right, that they're not really doing it until they get to the ha phase, but there's so like you need your do you have a son or daughter?
I have both.
You have both. Okay. So, yeah. But are you saying that you want them to experience slipping or maybe breaking something in the house so that they can truly learn the rule?
Not quite directly. I think of it more as an understanding. So I understand that there are some things, and this really depends on the person, the individual, we'll say maturity. With some things, people can be told something and that's it. I got it. I don't need to experience it. Most of us, though, aren't that way. And so to me, it's more of an understanding of, yes, I've told them 100 times and I'm going to have to keep telling them. And they're probably not going to truly appreciate it until they learn a reason, right? Until they hurt themselves. And so I'm not hoping they hurt themselves. I'm not like promoting that. But for my point, my own sanity, it's more of just an understanding is how I look at it.
Got it. You know, like another analogy, and I'm filling up this episode with some bad ones, but Jake's first Halloween that we were going to let him go alone, he wanted to bring shaving cream. And so, you know, we let him bring shaving cream, but I had a talk with him. And right beforehand, I said, hey, Jake, you know, you're going to wind up in a scenario where you or one of your friends or somebody who's near to your group of friends is going to do something. Right? Like that is definitely going to happen tonight. That's just what happens when you go out and get a little mischievous on Halloween. Your job is to, well, A, identify that before it happens to maybe stop it, right? But if you can't, your job is to figure out how to keep everybody safe in your group and, you know, keep some order around things, right? Hopefully nobody's going to get too hurt. Hopefully it's just a misunderstanding. And so we came back mm-hmm. that night. And apparently he had gotten shaving cream in somebody's eye and it wasn't somebody in the group. And a woman who wasn't even in any of the groups came over and grabbed the shaving cream out of Jake's hand and slapped him across the face. Right. And like, that's like inappropriate, you know, but he negotiated it, right? Like he negotiated that situation and figured out how to get his group, you know, out of the situation at home. And like, that's one of the great things about Jake as an adult now. He's 25, right? And he's mm-hmm. your height. But he knows how to handle situations. And I believe it's because we gave him that space to fail, right? To experience failure, right? Like I had no idea someone was going to slap him, you know, and we didn't live in a neighborhood where I was worried about somebody pulling out a knife or anything like that. But my correlation here is that I really think that in order for teams to get to that ha phase, right, they've got to experience the failure and the learning on their own. I think that's part of SHU. And if that's part of SHU, then not doing Scrum perfectly is also part of SHU. What do you think about that?
I mean, as we think about this and we're talking through it, I think about, you know, as a responsible coach or manager, right, looking over a team that's adopting Agile or Scrum, I do agree. There's, you know, there's different arguments for parenting styles, right? Free range to helicopter and anywhere in between. And with an organization, you probably have like fiduciary responsibilities to not let them just run the company into the ground. So there are guardrails, ideally, that we have up for the team, but they do need to experience, they do need to flounder. They can't get everything perfect all the time, or they're not going to learn. And they're not going to become a high-performing team. They're going to be walking on eggshells, and they're just not going to get it. Whether that is in the SHU or the HA phase, I mean, it might be pedantic, but for argument's sake, you know, I usually like to kind of think of it as, if you haven't tried it to the book, how do you know it doesn't work for you? All right. So to me, SHU is just like trying it. If you've never done it and you're like, that doesn't work for me, that's not a valuable argument to me, because experience does not equate, I'm trying to think how to word it right, but basically I've had so many times where teams and companies are like, that's not going to work for me. There's no way that'll work for me.
Yeah.
And then they actually try it and it does. And so I definitely think like you can have some knowledge beforehand, but truly trying it, there's no alternative to that.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that the moment of SHU is the moment of commitment to the process as written.
I think so. But I'm also not one of those like firm believers as well of, you know, you have to adopt everything all at once. And that's very disruptive. And that's the other question that I usually like to ask clients and companies is, you know, how disruptive do you want to be through this journey? If you want to disrupt everything and stop all operations and everything, we can change really fast. But most people don't have a tolerance for that much disruption. Usually they want to roll it out over time. And in that mindset, yeah, I wouldn't expect an organization to fully adopt Scrum. And that's why with my company, we don't even usually start with Scrum. We usually start with some Kanban basics or just teaching them the lean change management cycle. How do we experiment? How do we learn? How do we grow?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's funny. I find that most companies like are okay with starting with Kanban. But then again, now let's get back to this, like real Kanban, right? To me is harder than starting with just Scrum. And so at that point, like, you know, can you call it Kanban, or are you just using a Kanban board to start? Like, yeah. I hear you on both sides of it, right? Like it irks me when the purist comes out in people. And to me, the thing that's the most important, like out of it all, is the inspection and adaption. Right.
Mm-hmm.
If I have a customer who's, you know, doing everything wrong, but we're inspecting and adapting like once a sprint, I'm really happy. Like, that's awesome. Right. Because, you know, the door's not shut and that's still like, you know, they're in a growth mindset. If nothing is coming out of that right. inspection and adaption, I'm still happy. Right. Like, because we still have a foot in the door to be able to help people to learn over time, but it's not going to happen overnight. None of this is going to happen overnight. And people are used to driving the car with the waterfall steering wheel for so long now. There are these like arbitrary, like things that are like abstract kind of like barriers to entry that have been put in place over time to try to get things done faster. And those things need to come down in order for, mm-hmm. for us to scrum around the weird structures that are in place and stuff like that. I don't know. I think that like, it's okay if you're not shoeing perfectly, and it's okay if you haven't made a commitment yet, if you're just exploring the shoe, you know?
Yeah. And to go back to our child analogy, Like, our mission as a parent is to create a functioning adult who's able to function without us, right? Be able to interact with society and do what they need to do. And what that looks like is different to different people, but there is kind of an outcome there of like, well, they have to be on their own. And that's kind of a similar approach that I take as a coach, is I don't look at it and say, oh, you're doing Scrum by the book, you know, or I can check all these boxes for this list of practices. It's more of, are they showing the behaviors to continue learning and growing without me?
Yeah, that's a tough one. That's a tough one. You know, to get to that spot that's a great thing. You know, it's funny. I like loving this shoe analogy now. All right, like sometimes you got to just try it on for size.
For sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking about like the things that Jake started, but maybe never picked up or never really mastered. He was a snowboarder, right? And he wound up being a nationally competitive border cross snowboarder. I had all of these dreams for him with it. I was like, that's the coolest thing ever. You like this thing and you're good at it. And, you know, he was always tall and a big kid. And so he was able to compete in that really well, but he never practiced. But now the cool thing is, you know, he's 25 years old and he's a backcountry snowboarder. He loves it. He's created his own thing out of it. And there were times where he didn't want to snowboard anymore. And it was because I was putting too many rules on him. I was like sucking the fun out of the room, you know, by trying to make him this, you know, I don't know who the nationally competitive snowboarders are in border cross anymore, but you know, trying to make him the Shaun White of border cross, you know, and he just didn't want that. That wasn't something he wanted.
Yeah, lots of analogies there. I struggle sometimes with the same stuff, right? Where thinking from a parent's perspective, you know, how much do you encourage your child to try something or experiment with something before just saying like, oh, they're not interested anymore, or that's not right for them. You know, there's some dedication that I think like us as parents, us as coaches, us as managers have to trying to get individuals to actually truly try it, or to understand that we have ups and downs. But, you know, experimentation is, I think, critical to a developing human being, to a developing team. And if you try, like, in my opinion, an ideal scenario would be that a team tries Scrum for a little bit, and then they try Kanban for a bit, and then they try Less and Dead and whatever, right? They just try all these different flavors before deciding, oh, this is what works best for us. They're not usually given that grace or like that safe environment to experiment that much. And I think that's one of the challenges we have going into it. But you are also kind of hitting on some Stephen Covey for me, where, I admittedly have never finished, 7 Habits for Highly Effective People. Personally, I find the writing boring. Sorry, Stephen. But in the beginning, one of the things that really resonated with me is he talked about being a parent and how he was putting these projections on his son, and he was projecting himself and his own fears onto him. And it wasn't until he removed those and just showed love and compassion that he really started to thrive.
That's something I experience a lot as a coach, right? I realized a few years back that I was kind of being like Chicken Little, right? Like, if you don't do this and this, then this bad thing is going to happen, right? And people got really tired of that. So, you know, I figured out a way to be more cognizant of that. And again, like we talked about this, nobody likes a Scrum Poindexter or an Agile Poindexter.
Right. Yeah, the quickest way to alienate yourself from people is to be inflexible and constantly tell them what they're doing wrong.
Yeah. Okay, so let's get back to Shu again with that idea, right? Like, if that's if that's what we've got to do as coaches, right, is not alienate people and not overwhelm them, right? How can we Shu with them? Like, is that some pre-Shu phase?
I'm really feeling these kid analogies now too. You know, like if I pay for an instructor to come in, like let's say I want to learn the violin. So I pay for an instructor to teach me the violin. if I don't want to do things the way the violinist wants me to do them, they might just be like, all right, well, I'm just taking your money anyway. Or they're going to be like, find a different teacher. But when you're a parent paying for violin lessons for your child, which is, I don't know, I feel like I'm getting way into family analogies here, but like an organization, oftentimes you're paying for an agile coach on behalf of a team or on behalf of a department, right? Or the organization as a whole. Not everybody in the company is directly coming to you and saying, please coach me, please teach me. And so I do think there has to be some grace there and some understanding and figuring out, you know, how do I keep people engaged? How do I keep people learning and understand when they're overwhelmed and when they're not in a conducive state to learn?
So I was a ski instructor for a while, and I did a lot of beginners for kids and teenagers and a lot of adults. And the one thing that holds true with the beginner when you're teaching them to ski is that you've got to make their first day fun, right? Because if their first day is fun, they're going to have a second day. And if the third day is fun and fourth day is fun, right? Like at some point, like they're going to start to pick it up and learn it on their own. But I think there's, you know, a correlation there where you've got to make it fun, like energetic, engaging for people, right? You know, I would imagine, like, you know, with the judo analogy, like judo lessons, like nobody's coming to anybody's judo school for the first time, whether they're like a teenager or a fully formed adult to start learning judo for the first time, and is going to be like this judo robot that's going to sit there and, you know, put their hand into their fist and bow at the sensei and do all the moves properly and ready to soak up that knowledge, right?
There's muscles, right? You're using your muscles in ways you've never used before. We're not just going to like be shown how to do instruction once and get it perfectly right every single time and know how to apply it in the right situation every single time.
Yeah. Yeah. And the theory and the practice, right? Like there's the theory of throwing a punch, or I guess in judo, doing a flip or flipping somebody or transferring weight, right? Like actually, let's think about that for a second, right? Because judo is, right? Isn't it like the transferring of your weight to be able to use your opponent's weight against themselves and things like that?
Sounds right.
It's understanding like weight transfer, right? The principles of it, like the mechanics of it and whatnot. Like there's a lot of theory and practice in there, and you're not going to be doing it right. And you're not going to instantaneously understand the mechanics of it right off the bat, you know?
Yeah. And you're probably going to make some mistakes while practicing. But I guess my question then, going back to, you know, are you agile or not? Or are you Scrum or not? At what point do you call yourself a judo practitioner? I don't know what someone who does judo is that isn't a master. So we'll say practitioner. Like, at what point do you call yourself a judo practitioner? Is it, I purchased my white belt and I sat in one class. Now I'm a judo practitioner?
Yeah, it's a good question. Getting back to Jake and snowboarding, there's a fine line between being a great snowboarder because you are a great snowboarder and then looking like one until you become one. Mm-hmm. Like he needed the best gear. We didn't always get him the best gear, but like having good quality gear, having, you know, a good jacket, it's not inherent to being a great snowboarder. But at the same time, playing the part and feeling like you're playing the part can be helpful. And so if we're telling people you're not allowed to call it Scrum until some, you know, industry defined point, well, then that kind of makes sense a little bit because the industry is agreeing that this is where you have to be, right? In order to call yourself Scrum practitioners or whatever.
Yeah, you need the Scrum jacket.
But I think there's like the Scrum jacket. I think there's, you know, benefit to allowing our customers to play the part, you know, until they are the part, as long as we're there to guide them and help them to realize like, all right, you're doing Scrum, but there's a gap in between what you guys are doing and how you're doing it and how the Scrum guide. And so just be really careful with that.
Yeah, I think people get really, let's say, bamboozled by how short the Scrum guide is. It's the same thing with the Agile Manifesto, right? It's four values, 12 principles. It's very short. Yeah. And it seems really easy on the surface because of that. But if you think about the things that go into the Scrum Guide, the different elements of it, it is quite disruptive. And it's a huge commitment for organizations, some more than others. But to truly implement, like, truly cross-functional teams, right, that could require reorging your organization. Scrum Master is typically a new role. Is it a new title that we're creating? You know, product owner is a whole nother role as well. But there's a lot of politics and, let's say, transference of power and responsibility and all of that that happens. And so it's very, very disruptive to the point where I don't think organizations understand what they're getting into when they're starting it. It's just, this is the popular thing that everyone's doing.
So, okay, let's do a couple of scenario playing or role plays here, right? So let's say you've got an organization. They've got three project managers. One of them is trying to play the part of a Scrum Master. They've got 15 developers and testers, right? And there's like two or three BAs and a bunch of business stakeholders. Every 2 weeks, they do a sprint planning event. Then every 2 weeks, they do a sprint review, a sprint retrospective, and they do a daily scrum. Everybody's in it. Everybody's in these events, right? But they're mm-hmm. doing the events. Is that SHU yet?
I mean, I would argue yes. Yeah. It's, I mean, they're still learning the rules. And maybe that's it, learning the rules.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, there's impediments here, right? The impediment of having three project managers, no one who's called a product owner. There's no true Scrum Master. The team is too big, right? You know, maybe after like four or five cycles of running a retrospective, somebody brings a couple of those things up in a retrospective. And we talk about mm-hmm. it. And somebody says, what if we were to break this team down into two separate teams? And, you know, maybe, you know, you project manager, you seem to really be enjoying learning about the role of a Scrum Master. You know, I know that we can't change your title to Scrum Master, but, you know, would you be willing to be our Scrum Master in the role of our Scrum Master across these two teams, right? And, you know, maybe we break the teams down based on the work that's coming from the two separate project managers. Mm-hmm. And, like, maybe that's a learning that comes out of running retrospectives. I just worry that, like, if we're too prescriptive about saying, well, it has to be like this before you can say you're doing Scrum, that's going to get in the way of people leaning in. Somebody recently once said the best agile metric is the angle of your employees' chairs. Are they lean back or are they lean forward? Was that you said that or was that somebody else? I think it was
definitely not me, yeah. But I would love to steal credit for it.
So I don't know. Like, I didn't expect us to actually get an answer to this question. I really just kind of wanted to to talk about it out loud with you, you know, just to get some new insight and hear what your perspective was.
I agree. I think we can alienate people and companies, and I've seen that firsthand. I've probably done it firsthand, and you come in too strong. I see that a lot with agile assessments. Like, that's a really common tool, especially in consulting. Right, let me bring my spreadsheet or my clipboard, and, you know, let's check the boxes. Are you doing this? Are you doing this? Are you doing this? Here's your PowerPoint that says you're agile. But if we think about, like, the outcome, like, what are we trying to accomplish and what are the things that we're doing to help us accomplish it? That's more impactful and meaningful to me. So it's less on, am I going through these motions, and more on, how are the motions that I am doing affecting my ultimate goal?
So maybe the moment of SHU comes when the team is making a commitment to uncovering better ways of developing software and helping others to do it. Maybe that's it. You know, the other side of the coin, on the back side of things, all right, because I was thinking about this as well just now, not to jump away from that too quickly, but if you try to do Scrum and they're not doing it right, and, you know, 2 months, 3 months goes by and they hate you and now they hate Scrum, right? That's one, that's one reason why you shouldn't call it Scrum if you're not doing it by the Scrum Guide.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think that is the problem. And that is where some of the organizations responsible for Scrum have probably pushed back on that, is you do give it a bad name.
Yeah.
If it's not done right. And I've seen that countless times, right? Organization, Agile doesn't work here. Scrum doesn't work here. We've tried it. And it's nowhere even close to what it's supposed to be.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, there's all these governing bodies like we talked about in the last episode, right? And you could test for knowledge, but you can't test for culture. There's a lot of bad information out there.
Yeah, there's also, I'm struggling to think of an example off the top of my head, but I'm going to say it anyway. I've seen where somebody has interpreted the Scrum Guide in one way, and they're doing something that I never thought of or I've never seen before. And they're like, well, the Scrum Guide says this. And then I'm like, does it? And I'm like, double checking, like, what? And then you look and you read it, you're like, oh, yeah, it does, but I've never interpreted it that way before.
Yeah, there was an argument that was going on R Scrum on Reddit the other day, and I forget exactly what they were debating, but there were two people who had interpreted one aspect of the Scrum Guide completely different ways. And having read it now both ways, I was like, oh, okay, well, that is a valid point. I'm going to go back and find out which one that was that we're talking about. Oh yeah, I think I remember what it was. It was who writes the definition of done. All right, so let me pull that up. I've got the Scrum Guide right here. Let's see.
So who writes the definition of done per the Scrum Guide?
Yeah, let's see. Where does it say? It says it. So it says, I think the first instance of definition of done in the Scrum Guide is under developers, right? It says here, developers instill quality by adhering to a definition of done. Then it says that the Scrum Master helps the Scrum team to focus on creating high value increments that meet the definition of done. And they serve the product owner by helping find effective product goal definition. Oh, no, that's not it. For each selected product backlog item, the developers plan the work necessary to create an increment that meets the definition of done. Where does it say in here who writes it? Scrum team inspects how the last sprint went with regards to individuals, interactions, processes, and tools and their definition of done. Scrum artifacts. Scrum artifacts represent the work or value they designed. For the increment, it is the definition of done. The moment a product backlog item meets the...
If the definition of done for an increment is part of the standards of the organization, all Scrum teams must follow it as a minimum. If it is not an organizational standard, the Scrum team must create a definition of done appropriate for the product.
Okay, so this is what people were arguing about. Because then in the next line, it says the developers are required to conform to the definition of done. And so I think the argument was who writes the definition of done? And somebody was saying if the developers are required to conform to it, then the developers write the definition of done. But it says here clearly the Scrum team must create a definition of done. So it's the team.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is a common argument topic that I've seen in the community. I've seen in organizations. And I don't remember if it's always been this explicit, but it does state, right, that there can be an organizational definition of done. And most organizations won't have the definition of done, but they have things you have to do in order to release software. Those are non-negotiable for the definition of done. They have to go in. And then if you have multiple Scrum teams, they ideally are agreeing, this is what definition of done is for us. Where I've seen organizations struggle with that is like, well, this may not apply to all of our teams, or our teams feel like we're being micromanaged and that shouldn't be the case. I usually give the guidance that there are things that we know all teams have to do. That can be your organizational definition of done. And then your teams can add more to their definition of done, right? That's just the minimum, right? The minimum are the things that our organization needs us to do. In fact, I would encourage teams to have more.
Yeah, I'm trying hard not to bring my scaled agile stuff into this conversation and keep it purely at a Scrum. But I like to create definitions of done for everything. Definition of done for an increment, definition of done for a story. in a sprint. Definition of done for a bug, right? That might be different. Definition of ready. I like to create a lot of that, right? Like, what does it mean for a work item to be ready to be talked about in a team backlog refinement meeting event? What are we calling them now? Are we calling them, we're not calling them ceremonies, they're events, right?
They're events. Yep.
You know, what does it mean for a story to be ready for sprint planning?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. There's value in all of that. You know, entrance and exit criteria for, right, like your workflow or your columns on your board. Anything that creates transparency is going to help. And we don't want to be paralyzed because we have to define all these things at once. They're things that can grow with time, and we should evaluate, and we should make adjustments as we see fit. You know, if we think about, you know, the Agile manifesto again, right? Working software is our ultimate measurement. We should always be striving towards that. And most organizations aren't going to start with that. Most organizations aren't going to have where, you know, end of every sprint, we're releasing to production, let alone every time we complete an item, we're releasing to production. That doesn't mean that they're not agile if they are iterating and they're growing.
Yeah. That's always a tricky one to me that I have a hard time explaining to people, depending on the scenario, like, you know, when a team isn't able to release to production because it's part of the story's part of a feature that's being staged. I personally think that feature probably could have been better written if that's a problem that's been happening. But the definition of done for a story at the end of a sprint could be that it's checked into a testing environment.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I mean, I would encourage at least testing environment, because the whole point is, can it run? And that's a transparency thing.
Yeah. Well, I'm still going to argue that if teams are having these kinds of discussions, debates, and whatnot, you know, even if they don't have the thing in place perfectly, if they're not adhering to all aspects of the Scrum guide, they're still a Scrum team, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to be a Scrum team, and so I still feel that the Shuhari analogy is a little too prescriptive. And it's going to force people away as opposed to draw people in.
Yeah, I could see that. Especially if you try to be rigid with it and be like, no, you're Shu. You can't experiment at all. You can't do anything. Or you're not Shu. And like, you have to incorporate all these things before you're allowed to experiment. I definitely agree with that. You know, and if a team is arguing about something like the definition of done, it means they care, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the lean of the chair. Are they leaning into it or are they leaning away from it?
And some of the arguments we have, like when I try to objectify myself, not just in Agile, like in the business world in general, as a manager, as a human being, try to remove myself from the situation and just kind of like look at it like I'm someone who has no knowledge of the situation, or like I'm an alien, right? There's like a comic strip I love where they like objectively look at things the human race does as aliens, and it's pretty funny. Usually the things we're like super heated up about or passionate or arguing about are so trivial and so silly when you look at it objectively.
Yeah, and it's the label. That's the thing that always cracks me up, is when the thing that everybody's arguing about is the exact same thing, right? It's just one's called this and the other's called that. Names just get in the way of so much. I actually had an organization that they wouldn't let me call them. This is way back when they wouldn't let me call it a ceremony. And I was like, fine. Okay. Let's call it a meeting. Right. Let's call it a sprint planning meeting. Like, are we doing the sprint planning meeting the way that the Scrum guide says a sprint planning event should be conducted? Yes. Okay. Then call it Fred. Like, let's call it Fred.
Yeah, especially as a consultant, we take the same approach. If someone's like, I hate Scrum, Scrum is worthless, we tried it, it doesn't work for us, or I hate Agile, it's like, all right, cool. Have you ever applied Lean to your software development cycle? Or, you know, let's apply empiricism or the scientific method. Or, you know, there's so many different words for it that it just seems pointless to get caught up on it. Or when I think about the Scrum Guide, so I want to say it was 2 years ago, the Scrum Guide went through a major overhaul. A lot of stuff got cut. It got even more simplified. Self-organizing changed to self-managing. And I think about all the times I sat in a room with all of these, as you said, Scrum Poindexters, all these like people arguing about these words and these elements in the guide that no longer exist now.
Yeah.
Like, how beneficial was that?
Yeah, I wish I could find that post again. I'll send it to you. I'll look it up. All right. So having spoken about this, where do you sit on Shuhari and calling it Scrum?
You know, I've never really thought about the concept like this in depth before, I don't think. It's something I've referred to often, and it's Japanese, and we love to steal Japanese phrases as Agilists. So, of course, I love that aspect of it. But I think if we were to get like really pedantic with it, and it's more than just like an understanding that people need to learn and then break the rules and then they become the master, I'm going to give it like kind of thumbs down. Like, I don't know if it's an analogy I'm going to really use a lot going forward now that we really kind of boiled the ocean here.
I like the analogy, but with two caveats. I either like it as is, if we agree that shoeing is inclusive of trying on the shoe. Right. If it's not inclusive of trying on the shoe, then we need a pre-shoe. We need something, right? Because I think really what I'm saying is that I don't like the idea of being so prescriptive to say that you're not doing Scrum, you know, if you're not doing it perfectly. That to me has too much exclusivity to it. And, it puts the point of the barrier to entry too high for teams to be able to just try it on and see how it works.
Yeah, I almost wonder if it's just not a great, like if it doesn't map over great from martial arts to the software development world as well. I mean, sure, you're not going to get everything right initially when you're learning judo, for example, earlier, but you're going to be instructed on a specific way to do it. And if you're not doing it that specific way, then it's not judo, right? At what point are you able to deviate and still call it judo? I don't know. I'm not a martial artist. Is it like the Bruce Lee thing where, you know, he learned Wing Chun, but then he went like MMA on it and like mixed all this stuff and made his own? You know, I'm not the martial arts police, just like I'm not the agile police. I'm not the one that decides that. I do think there are certain things that if you don't do them, you're probably not going to have a good time.
Well, so looking at the Wikipedia page, which is the best source of information, so take that with a grain of salt. Shu means to protect or obey. It's the phase of traditional wisdom, learning fundamentals, techniques, heuristics, and proverbs. Ha means detach or digress. So it's breaking with tradition, detachment from the illusions of self-view. And then re is leave or separate, transcendence. There are no techniques or proverbs. All moves are natural, becoming one with spirit alone without clinging to forms, transcending the physical. I don't think I've ever worked with a team that was really at a re level of Scrum of any way, shape, or form, if we're looking at it from that perspective.
Yeah, I don't know if I've worked with a team that's like transcended current agile knowledge and is like paving the way with new agile things. I've been on very progressive teams that I would say were ahead of the industry.
Yeah, I'd say more often than not, the teams that want to leave, separate, and transcend are doing so as a way to avoid. Well.
Yeah, I usually like to think of agile as like enlightenment. And we're striving for enlightenment. Well, if that's your beliefs, whatever. But like, if you're striving for enlightenment, you never truly get there. Right? It's something we strive for. And agility is the same way to me. There's always a way to be more agile. There's no such thing as I'm completely agile. There's nothing else I can improve or get better at.
Okay, here's something that I just found. So in this definition of Shu, which comes from Aikido master Endo Saishiro Shihan, it says, in Shu, we repeat the forms and discipline ourselves so that our body absorbs the forms that our forebears created. We remain faithful to these forms with no deviation. So it is being defined as being faithful to the form without any deviation. So maybe by that definition, I'm like completely wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess the question is, right, like if we look at it from a school of martial arts, right, what is the outcome of learning martial arts? Is it being able to fight well? Well, you might not need to learn a traditional way of fighting from a school. Maybe, I don't know, you're just magic and you're a great fighter.
Yeah. I wonder if, like, you brought up belts before, like if there is a certain belt that is thought of as Shu. There probably is.
So I just thought of this. I have a friend who's an agile coach and is a black belt and has given presentations, kind of mixing the two. So I'm going to reach out to him. I'm going to see if he has any guidance here, if he has any thoughts.
Let's do that. That would be absolutely awesome to get that knowledge in there. All right. So I feel like I've learned something in this episode. And I think that my viewpoint now is that Shu is the commitment to the form of Scrum, as the Scrum Guide describes it. That what I'm talking about is something ahead of Shu, but that I still feel like we can't be too exclusive, you know?
Yeah, I mean, maybe there. I mean, I don't think of it also as like a finite thing. Like you could be going through different phases of these at different times with different things.
I just still don't like when people say, you know, don't call it Scrum if you're not doing it in accordance with the Scrum Guide. I think that that's a very harsh statement that could be rewritten in a way that is kinder and gentler and welcoming of people trying.
Yeah, I'm torn on it because as you pointed out earlier, Scrum gets a bad name a lot. And so I definitely see that opinion and that argument. But I try to always be inclusive with everything. Like I don't like when we use something as a barrier for people.
It would be cool if there was something along the lines of like, if you're on a Scrum team, your team could submit, either your Scrum Master could submit to the Scrum Alliance some sort of like team charter, like. They submit their team working agreement, right? And the recommendation of that Scrum Master to assign that Scrum team as, you know, officially a Shu level Scrum team.
I think we need to get two Scrum teams on the mat and they need to face off.
What would your Agile Coach wrestler name be?
Oh, man. That's too much pressure to come up with one on the spot.
By the way, you don't know this about me, but I live one block away from where WWE's new building is being built right now. They've got the WWE lights at the top of the building that were illuminated maybe like 2 months ago. I don't know when Stephanie McMahon is moving in, but I'm really hoping that at some point I see some interesting wrestlers. I'd love to is the Iron Sheik still alive? I mean, that's how old I am.
I'm not sure.
I know Rowdy Piper's passed away, but I'd love to see Sergeant Slaughter coming in one day. It won't happen, but
yeah, I just want to see them in the spandex and the face paint and the tassels with a briefcase walking in the building.
You know, one thing I will say is that my one rule of thumb with Scrum teams. And this is not true, but I definitely tell everybody this. Whenever they're picking team names, I remind them politely that if anybody chooses either Team Transformers or Team Avengers, I'm walking out of here. Tired. You know, I'm almost the same way with James Bond movies, but definitely Marvel, and I'm done with it. Don't name your Scrum team a Marvel team.
I could see that. Yeah. My first team, I think, was the Lean Machine.
I saw one, and so this is not firsthand knowledge, but the best Scrum team name that I ever heard was Scrum Dog Millionaire.
It's pretty good.
Well, Brad, I got to go get my dog. I've got some time, but I feel like it's a...
Don't leave your poor dog.
If we're talking about wrestler names and Scrum team names, it might be time to...
Be time to wrap it, yeah.
So give us your feedback. You know, give me a big, swift kick to the head. Tell me... tell me I'm totally wrong and I'm a bad agilist just for even thinking these things, let alone recording myself saying them out loud.
Judo chop.
Give me a Ray judo chop to the head. I don't want any of the that weak shoe judo chop to the head. If you're going to judo chop me, give me a Ray. Where it's the end of the year, we've got, I think, one more episode that we're recording this year, which we're excited for. And we're going to be launching in January. So if you're listening to this, Happy New Year, because it's probably January.
Yes. Happy New Year. And looking forward to getting this out there. And we're going to be a lot more aggressively tapping people to join us too.
Oh, definitely. For sure. Awesome. Hello@agileforagilist.com is the email address. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch up with you guys soon.
Thanks, everyone.